Thanks very much, sir. Tom Shediak writes, as I write this, I feel a bit like I'm Jim and you perhaps are the unsuspecting hikers. You'll find out about that in a minute. I'm the last person you might expect to deliver a message about fixing a world gone wrong. I am, after all, in the eyes of that world, just a comedy director. Ace Ventura, The Nutty Professor, Liar Liar, Patch Adams, Bruce Almighty, Evan Almighty, which makes me an unlikely source for the content of this book. So unlikely, it took a near-death experience to give me the courage to share my story. First in the documentary I Am, and now here. In this book, Life's Operating Manual, with the Fear and Truth Dialogues. Tom Shediak is next on Coast to Coast AM. The aforementioned recent brush with death compelled Tom Shediak to make his latest film, I Am, a documentary that asks some of today's most profound thinkers two questions. What's wrong with the world and what can we do about it? To which most of us will answer all kinds of stuff and I don't know. Welcome to the program, Tom. It's great to have you back. You haven't been on since 2011 with Ian.
Yeah. That was after we released I Am. So good to be back. I'm usually asleep at this hour, but I'm happy to put on my marathon legs. So thanks for having me.
Well, believe it or not, so am I. I keep a daylight schedule during the week. And I'll tell you what, that's why I call it Zombie Jombi Weekends, because I was on last night and I'm on tonight. And on Monday, I will be a zombie.
Keep going, man. Keep going.
Yeah. Got to. I'll be mellow when I'm, well, when I've checked out of here. When you see the smoke coming from the chimney, then you'll know I've retired.
Yeah, in show business, we do these things. You learn in college to do all-nighters. In show business, we have to do all-night shoots, and you kind of push through. So hopefully we'll make some sense.
You know, this is quite a nice book that you've written, and you've done so much stuff. I really don't know where we can start, but I guess we'll start with it. First of all, I am pronouncing your name correctly. It is Shediak, yes?
Shady like a tree, A-C on the end of it, yeah.
Okay, gotcha. Well, my dad always taught me, don't get the name wrong. That's just not good.
I'm used to it. It's all good. No, you got it right, Shediak, yeah.
Okay, swell. Now, you went to film school, I guess, and then and you've been in Hollywood for the majority of your career. Maybe you still are, and you've done a lot of great pictures, and made a lot of money, and somehow you find yourself rejecting the materialistic thing and looking for the real meaning of life.
Well, the real meaning, if you will, was not in the materialistic things. I don't think I'm the first one to say it or experience it. It was a bit shocking to me because the culture has such a promise attached to getting there, if you will, defining success as material goods and wealth and a certain house and security. And, when I got those things, I found them at best neutral, and there was something that woke up in me that felt hypocritical. I was raised in the Catholic faith, and I never was a fan of the dogma or the exclusivity of the faith, but I did find the moral values very powerful, and I wanted to tend my life toward those values. And I found myself, as I looked at it, hypocritical, storing up treasures on earth, which we're told not to do, serving two masters, God and money, et cetera. And if it had worked, then I would tell a different story. In other words, if the money had come and that quote-unquote material success had come and it had brought such a joy, such a, effusive spirit, such a zest for life. But as I said, it was neutral, at best neutral. And the opposite was true. The more I've given away, the more I've shared, the more I've served in my life, that's brought a joy, that's brought a spark to my life. So I've just kind of turned it upside down. And again, I'm not the first one to do it, but hopefully, more can look at these principles in their own life.
Tell us I'm reading it, of course, but tell everybody the Jim Carrey story and the hikers.
Oh, we were in Alaska. We had finished Liar Liar, and we went up to this very remote lodge. There's not a paved road for 200 miles, and everything's done by a plane up there, little float planes and whatnot. And we were in a Beaver de Havilland flying around, and our pilot got news of some hikers that were stranded on a glacier. It was kind of an emergency situation. No one was hurt or anything, but they needed gas. And I had the crazy idea, because Jim and I were on that flight, and I said, Jim, why don't you deliver the gas? So, here we were in this incredibly remote place on a glacier landing, and Jim runs out of the plane. Nobody knows it's him. He's got a parka on and a hood covering his face. And pulls the hood down, holds the gas can up, and says, "Hi, I'm Ace Ventura. I heard you needed some gas." And, of course, everybody was shocked. And then he said nothing else. He delivered the gas. They were, you know, the waves of shock went through the group. And he last thing he said was, "Tom Cruise will be by later with some trail mix." And he turned on his heels, he walked back to the plane, and we took off, and that was it. So, yeah, I shared that story in the book because, as you said on one of the breaks earlier, you know, those hikers were shocked. The last person they expected to deliver gasoline was Jim Carrey on a glacier in Alaska. And I feel that as a comedy director who's done from Ace Ventura to Nutty Professor to Bruce Almighty, I think those in this country and maybe others in the world may think that that director of those movies might be the last person who might have a perspective on how we can correct our course. So that's why I shared that story to begin with the book with.
I think it's interesting that you said that you were raised in the Catholic faith and that the serving two masters, the money and the deity, was that those are mutually exclusive. And you have these wonderful quotes in your chapters. Like this one: "If you would be a real seeker after truth, it is necessary that at least once in your life you doubt, as far as possible, all things."
Yeah, that's Descartes. Yeah, mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that's a premise I teach also. I teach college and I teach some high school, and I start with this isn't your orientation, this is your disorientation. And what Descartes is saying is that we've got to question these ideas that we've been taught. We've got to measure them against our lives and our experience, and let's hang on to everything that's true, and then let's let go of everything that doesn't feel true. And that takes courage, and most of us don't even realize we are fashioning our lives around ideas that have been fed to us, kind of like a hypnotist does, that we've heard through our parents, and they were told to their parents and media and culture. But those, I think, on the hero's journey, as Joseph Campbell calls it, that actually call into question what they've been taught, they can often lead lives that are very authentic and very powerful and can change things.
What happened to you?
Oh, my goodness. I'm glad we're talking for 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to me? Well, where do we start? You want alphabetically? You mean in terms of...
Your near-death experience, the one that...
Yeah. Well, yeah. Look, some people who have seen my film misunderstand and think that I hit my head. I got in a bike accident and nearly died. A concussion turned into post-concussion syndrome, and that's a brutal condition that, you know, athletes get, the hockey players, football players, and the symptoms of a concussion simply just don't go away. But people think that I had that happen to me, and, you know, I felt I was going to die, and then I suddenly, quote, saw the light or had some revelation. I had been changing my life for years before that, again, waking up to those hypocrisies that I had just told you about, you know, about not storing up treasures on earth, but serving with your life, making love the aim of a life. And so I'd, you know, shifted my life. I'd already moved into a beautiful mobile home park, but still a mobile home park. I'd given away a lot of my things, et cetera, recrafted the way I was doing economy in my life. But what the accident made me do was share my story. I had done all this in a closet, and when I faced my own death, thought I was going to die, I just got hit with a very tangible, real, that inner voice spoke up loudly and said, "If this is your last chapter, you must share what you've experienced and offer that before you go." So that's why I made I Am, which led to this book.
And when you say it was a bike accident, is that a motor-driven bike or...?
No, bicycle, yeah. I didn't drive much in L.A. All these years, you know, I was one of those people who complained about traffic. But using the Descartes principle, I realized I was traffic. You know, you're sitting in traffic complaining about traffic, then you turn the question inward and you realize, oh, wait a second, I am traffic. So I wanted to do my part to ameliorate that problem. So I biked a lot. It was great for my health, and, you know, maybe I added one tiny iota of improvement to the city.
Sure. Well, it appears, I made this statement last night, and I made it before on a fellow show, David Schrader, that the awakening that we wanted in 2012, we were hoping for, a lot of people are so they're in such despair over the condition of the world. They were hoping for some sort of an awakening, even if it was Nibiru crashing into the planet and resetting the whole global civilization back to zero, so we could start it again. And I've often said that a good chair doesn't make us more fit; it makes us less fit in every department. And that my martial arts master always said, he wrote in his books, there's no limit to the laziness of a human being. The first they want to sit, and then they want to lie down because the chair is not good enough for them. And then all of this turmoil over the money and this continual race for more stuff. I mean, we were laughing at ourselves a little bit as far back as the 80s with the "he who dies with the most toys wins." Mm-hmm. And then inevitably I return to, and I'll tell you, this always tweaks the atheists, but just roll with me for a second. I came across a proverb written by King Solomon, and in it he said, all these orchards that I planted and these things that I built, and I had children and I had slaves, both female and male slaves, and slave children were born in this house, and I look back on it now and I realize it was all for vanity. And I started thinking, I wonder how much I've done in my life that really was toward that end, just vanity, whether it was the hot car or whether it was the hot this or the hot that. I wonder if it's because I really thought it was cool, or if it was really vanity and an attempt to somehow, you know, elevate myself above my peers by, look what I have. Isn't this cool? This is a cool trinket. And, oh, look, this one has wheels. Is this the sort of materialism that you're talking about that you've turned away from?
Well, yeah. And you know, I think humanity is being led on an evolving course. That's what the mystic poet Rumi believed. He calls it the migration of intelligences. And the fact that you also experienced what you might label vanity, whether it's a car or, you know, a certain a purchase that you made, and I experienced that in some way, allows us to be on this radio now to speak to others about the emptiness of that. So I think that even the dark things that are going on, even the tendency, if you will, away from the light, pulls us back toward the light because the light is stronger than the darkness. So I think that that's scientific. I think that whatever force set this universe up, call it the big electron, as George Carlin used to call it God, as some of those in the faith traditions call it, whatever force set this up knew that if the laws of life were not such that the light and love was stronger than the darkness, we would not make it for long at all. Because a Hitler would come along and we'd all go, hey, that's awesome, let's go do that. But the opposite happens. A Hitler comes along and we say never again. Our hearts burst with compassion, and the world works to see that that doesn't happen again. So I think that if you look at the news, you can get really discouraged, you know, because the news is all the things that went wrong today. But as I point out in the book, and Jeremy Rifkin, you know, in his book, The Empathic Civilization, turned me on to this idea, the news doesn't report all that's going right. All the millions of acts of kindness, all the millions of acts of cooperation that go into our daily routines. But it does report the one guy who steals a car or abuses a child. That's what makes the news, and we think it's our story. And I think there's a more powerful story underneath, and at some point it's going to tip. And when it does tip, I think we'll look back on where we are now and see how much we've grown, like we did when it was just fine to have a slave, or it was just fine to chop a head off in a ritual sacrifice. I think we're going to see the way we do economy now, the way we educate, were some dark days. And I think at some point it's going to tip. And I think we're on that course. We just may not be able to see it.
I think that we have had our awakening, and we have awakened to the fact that we have been shrouded in darkness for a long time, which makes me want to go to this one in your Fear and Truth dialogues, going back to the Native American myth about the warring wolves. Which wolf wins, the wolf of fear or the wolf of truth? I take it that mostly what we're getting from the news would be food for fear.
Right. The end of that story is this one you feed. And many of us feed fear. Of course, we feed fear. We don't realize we're feeding fear. And so we become what we feed. Literally, it's the simple spiritual or emotional idea from the physical, you are what you eat. And so we are eating, if you will, we're ingesting so much fear, toxic ideas of, you know, the violence in the world and the screaming matches at each other, childish behavior in politics and, you know, not just wars of words, but wars of guns. And we lock our doors at night and get security systems and want to set ourselves up and store up those treasures and worry about tomorrow. And we don't even realize it. It just becomes, you know, and then we make it a positive. And then the news say, you know, get set for life, get comfortable. You made a very good point earlier, a very perceptive point, which is comfort is actually in a lot of ways the challenge. You know, Emerson said people wish to be settled. Only in so much as they are unsettled is there any hope for them. And the unsettled is when we have a chance to learn something. And so complacency happens. While we sit on the cushion of advantage, we fall asleep. And so complacency happens, and then we don't move the conversation forward. And again, that's media. It's that cultural hum, but it's also us. I don't think these things exist outside of us. I think the media and the cultural hum is the collective energy of the individuals who are buying into it. So at some point in your life, as you've already pointed out, Descartes says, question it. Do you want to be a part of that cultural hum, or do you want to tell a different story with your life? And I'm hoping to tell a different story with my life.
You know, Tom, people will say things that sound really profound, and such as, imagine what we could do if we could free ourselves from fear. And the people who hear this go, yes, yes, this is profound. But they can't really get very, very deep into that. But just, I would think a rudimentary example would be, remember when it's really calmed down a lot. It still occurs, but do you remember road rage? How much of that was going on, and how much of it was being reported back in the 80s and even
sure.
the 90s?
Of course, yeah. Mm-hmm.
My martial arts master told me something very interesting about that once, and I had never thought about it before. He said, when you see two people engaging in that, first one of them says something to the other guy, rolls his window down. That's the first challenge. And the other guy responds with some ugliness. And then next come the gesticulating broadly with the middle finger salute. Now they're swerving. He said, you know what all that is? I said, no, what? Anger? He said, no, it's fear. I started thinking about that, and it's true. When somebody acts aggressively toward you to quell this, you're afraid because you're now being set upon by this person's ugliness. So you respond with more ugliness.
Yeah.
And again, going back to that old book, it says don't return ugliness with ugliness.
Yeah.
But the fact that it's fear-based in Master's mind really got me.
He's right. And I think there's something even beneath the fear. Fear is always based on disconnection and not seeing things as they are. If you could see actually your connection to that other driver, and there's a scientific connection, there's an emotional connection, there's a physiological connection, because we all come from the same two genetic parents in sub-Saharan Africa. We know that scientifically. So if you saw things as they were, fear would dissipate. We could move right through fear. Fear is not seeing things as they are. And so what the car does is it exacerbates fear, because it puts up a wall of disconnection, glass and metal and speed, between you and another human being. The internet is doing that now. You know, you don't have a phenomenon called grocery line rage. You know, if we wait in line,
right,
probably longer lines than the grocery line, but we can feel the person in front of it. We feel their energy. We can feel the sigh if they've had a hard day. And you very, very rarely see grocery line rage. But you do see internet bullying, and you do see road rage, because it is about disconnection. And I believe the way things, and Einstein said this, that the fundamental nature of reality, and Emerson said it, and all the poets have said it, and the philosophers, that everything is one. It's connected. And until we see that we actually are a family, it's that simple, us and life, then we continue to, you know, just spin these problems and recycle them over and over.
Gotcha. Tom Shadyac is our guest tonight. We'll be right back. Thanks for being here, Tom, and thank you for being here as well. This is Coast to Coast AM. Maybe that should be the theme of tonight's program. Hey, good thing, where have you gone? You know, Albert Einstein said a new type of thinking is essential if mankind is to survive. I didn't know he said that until I looked at the beginning of this chapter, The World is Broken, in the book Life's Operating Manual by Tom Shadyac, film director, many blockbuster hits, creator of the documentary I Am, and the author of this book, Life's Operating Manual, with the Fear and Truth Dialogues. We'll be right back. Give us just 2 minutes. We'll have some of your calls later because I know some of you are going to want to talk to Tom. Please stand by. This is the one and only Coast to Coast AM. Tom, what was it about the post-concussion syndrome that made you change the way you look at life? Did you really feel like this was not going to go, these symptoms were not going away, and that you might have just a small window to go through and get what you needed done and get what you needed said?
Yeah. Again, it changed one thing very specifically, because I had already changed my perspective, and it's still evolving, of course. But post-concussion, after 4 months of struggling with this, you can imagine if you had a voice, a sound in your head, like a static sound in your head, that the volume was at a 9 from a scale of 1 to 10, and it was going off in your head, and you couldn't turn it down, and that was just a day. Imagine 4 months of it. Gosh. And sensitivity to light and sound and stimuli, the only thing that would help is no stimuli, sleeping in a closet, putting blackout curtains over windows. And I just finally said, if this is it, if this is as good as my health gets, I'm not going to make it. And so I very clearly then, death is a very powerful motivator. It refines things. And I simply said, if I'm going out, I want to talk about these things that I feel passionately about, my experiences, the reinvention of my life, the questioning of those hypocrisies in my life, the challenging those fears, and I went ahead and made I Am, and it just walked. And now I walk, I feel more authentically. I'm not afraid to be on a show like this and talk about my heart and talk about, my imperfections in my journey. And it's not just about making the next blockbuster. It's about living a life that's as powerful as any story I'll ever tell.
Did you have a feeling of calm? I mean, were you resolved that I need to get this done? Did you feel like it's not like a panic to get this done? Was it, you were set upon by that emotion? Was it more of a resolution that I have to do this?
Yeah, there's a still point that the poet T.S. Eliot talks about, the still point of the turning world. There the dance is. That's the calm you're talking about. And there was a storm, and this was the calm. And it was very powerful, and it was very short-lived. Because once I knew I had to do something and I had to go on this journey, then fear, that loud squawker, pipes up and says, well, you've never made a documentary. Who are you? People are going to think you're crazy. You're supposed to go out and make another big blockbuster comedy. And so I, of course, stared at that fear, looked at that fear, and moved through that fear. And did finish the film, and I Am, and again, continue on this journey.
It says here in this chapter, The World is Broken, and that quote from Einstein, a new type of thinking is essential if mankind is to survive. What's your appraisal of the current condition of mankind, globally speaking?
I think mankind is an incredible species, and I say that with a big asterisk, because we're not behaving in a way that is actually, again, who we are. We have become myopic in many places. We're short-sighted. And again, I've been a part of the short-sightedness. We've become blinded to this idea that, Einstein did a lot of philosophical musing after he looked at the world and the actual practical meat and marrow of life and cells and the particles that make up life. And he became a philosopher, and his philosophy boiled down to seeing the world for what it is, this connection that we're all family. And he said that the way that the poison is showing up today in society is through the economy, Because when you really break it down, if there's Republicans listening, Democrats, liberals to this show, conservatives, we could talk about honoring families and that human beings, you know, the highest aim is to be compassionate and empathetic and love and all that stuff. And everybody would, of course, agree. The second we say love has to walk in your business life, you have to treat others as family, that maybe cooperation ought to be a higher ideal than competition, then suddenly you hear the record scratch. And because we've bought this idea that if you look at it, it has no solid foundation. We say what's going to motivate a young person to be inventive and have, quote, ambition with their life if they can't get rich, if they can't get a mansion? And you say, well, what motivated Jonas Salk when he invented the polio vaccine? He did it to when he found the polio vaccine, he did it to benefit all mankind, and he died so wealthy because he saved countless lives. You know, why is it that we think that is the highest aim, and that's the highest motivating factor? We talk about profit in terms of money. We don't talk about the profitability of serving with your life, of dedicating whatever your talents are to the good of all. It's what Einstein said. We lost this idea of the social function as a positive. And this is not a socialistic idea. You know, it's not about a system. This is about the way life actually thrives. And all systems that are thriving in nature are in states of cooperation in the long run. They can be competitive, but over competition breaks systems down, and eventually those systems can die off because they destroy diversity, et cetera. That's what a cancer does. It eats its host, et cetera. And we're sort of blind to it. We feel it in our moral teachers. You know, we feel that the power of love, we feel it. We see it. You know, and you used to watch Oprah, and you would see these loving acts every day, these connected acts between people, and we would tear up instantly. But then we turn the TV off, and we go out, and, you know, it's not eat, pray, love, it's eat, pray, shove, you know. And I think we're waking up to this. I that's my hope. It's my hope. But many still are playing a note as counter to that. You know, that is the note of what I'm saying is unrealistic. It's not how man is wired, which I don't agree with, you know, based on all the science that says our bodies react to positive emotions like love, compassion, kindness, appreciation, connection, gratitude. It renews our cellular functions. It renews our immune systems. It leads to the brain being optimal in terms of flow and processing of information. The opposite happens in negative, angry, aggressive states. You get early onset diseases, stress-related diseases, heart attacks, et cetera. And a mad athlete is a bad athlete. You cut off the flow to the brain, et cetera. So I think that the idea that love is how we're going to move forward and we're going to get it as a family is actually written in the marrow of life. And I hope and pray and think we're going to get there.
Now, you don't have a background in psychology, do you? Did you study it at all?
Oh, I'm practicing without a license. I've studied it through 20 years of therapy, reading every book possible. I have a doctorate of experience in psychology.
Understand.
Yeah. So I don't have a doctorate, but I would happily debate and have a conversation, a robust conversation with anyone with a doctorate.
It's amazing how the world opens up to you once you're freed from the constraints of academia. So I would say your degree in psychology is probably every bit as valuable by about triple than one that you could that you could get by simply by going to the college bookstore and buying the book and actually reading it instead of chapters 2 through 5 and then skip over to 14 because we're not covering that this semester. I want to pose a question to you. We've seen children that, I don't know why it was always Johnny, but that's the way it was. I don't think I was scarred by that. But Johnny messes up. And maybe a couple of his little friends are around to observe him messing up and being reprimanded by the authority figure, the parent. And so it's like, now don't do that anymore, darn it, you know, and just stop that and straighten up. Now we're going to have our cake now. Now there's other children enjoying the cake, but the one who was called out, little Johnny, doesn't want to eat his cake. You know the child wants to eat the cake, but then no. He says, no, I don't want it. Pushes it away. And you know that kid wants that cake. Do you think that that is something that is inherent in most of us as adults where, yes, we do have those moments when we reach out and we really connect with a human being and the compassion shows up on the scope and we connect just for a minute and then we push the cake away?
Yeah. Well,
Well, what is that component?
Well, we certainly have that capacity. We have the capacity to push the cake away. You can call it stubbornness, ego, learning your boundaries. But I simply ask this question to Johnny as he goes through his life. Hey, Johnny, how's that working out for you? You've pushed your cake away for your entire life. All the other kids have, you know, enjoyed dessert. Let's call this a healthy cake. So it's, you know, made with healthy ingredients. The other kids are enjoying a nice, healthy dessert, and you keep pushing it away. How's that working out for you?
Is that self-punishment, Tom?
Is it self-punishment? You know, I think we're experimenters by nature. You know, we experiment with things, and again, I think it's fear. We protect ourselves. You know, we it's all really about love. If you really look at Johnny, what he's saying is I'm not being loved. That's really what he's saying. And I want to be loved, so I'm going to be different, and I'm going to push the cake away. And I think this is the way to get love. I really, truly believe that this is the deepest longing in all of us. And again, it's because it's how we're going to survive. It's how we do survive. And so I think Johnny is just living, if you will, the shadow side of the love story. He's pushing it away. And so maybe over the course of his life, he'll be standing before people on a radio show saying, hey, I pushed that cake away my whole life, and it got me in the hospital, it got me a divorce, it got me in bankruptcy court, and now I've invited the cake in, and here I am, and let me tell you guys, you Johnnies out there, invite the cake in.
You know, I got a very quick story for you. I know of a young lady who, when she was a child, told her daddy, you haven't done anything today to make me happy. All you've done is make me mad and hurt my feelings.
Yeah.
And the dad corrected his behavior real quick because he was obviously, if you'll excuse the terminology, absorbed in his own trip to the point where he was just insensitive.
Yeah, kids are amazing. I mean, yeah, this is why, you know, Thoreau said, I'm always regretting the fact I'm not as wise as the day I was born. Kids, and of course they have much to learn, but kids have much to teach. And they will say those honest things. They will run right up to you and say those honest things. And again, we pull them out of that youthful light. Sadly, society often pulls them out. But the strong ones pull back into their own authenticity, and they retain that youthfulness, that sense of honesty, that sense of authenticity into adulthood.
You know, in one of your chapters here, it says the world is not to be put in order. This is Henry Miller.
Yeah.
The world is not to be put in order. The world is in order. It is for us to put ourselves in unison with this order. So how do we go about doing that? Well, just in our individual lives before we can...
First of all, just look at the world. That's the first thing you do. How's it working for the world? One thing we've done, though, we've already ascribed our story to the world. So, you know, we don't see things as they are. We see them as we are. So because we are overly competitive, we think we've subscribed this idea that nature is all about survival of the fittest and it's over competition, et cetera, only the strong survive. And that's all a misunderstanding of Darwin and Kropotkin and all these guys who saw cooperation and sympathy as the ruling order of nature. First thing you do is look at nature. Look at that. That's why when we walk back into nature through our stressful lives, that's a great way to start, by the way. Walk into nature. Walk into the simplicity and the complexity and the beauty and the inner workings and the outer workings of a rainforest, of a field, walk around a lake, a stream, or along a stream bed, and we all feel something. We get reconnected with something. That's a beautiful way to start. I like to encourage people if something that, you know, whether it's this book or something else you see, makes sense, start talking about it. Start a conversation. Questions are the most powerful tools that we have. And it takes courage, as Rainer Maria Rilke said, to live these questions. And if people can have the courage to say, I heard this crazy director on this radio show and maybe think about something, you know, or I heard this, you know, John on this radio show, let me ask you a question. What do you think? How is it that we walk out of church empowered with love and saying we're all brothers and sisters, and then on Monday we go tear each other asunder and we call ourselves winners and losers, and the losers oftentimes don't eat, but some of us are so fat that we can't even think about how much money we have. What, don't you find it something odd in that? Start a conversation. You know, that's how I started. When I woke up to how I did economy, which is outside the bounds of nature, nothing in nature is really taking more than it needs. And when it does, it's a behavior that will not allow that species to survive. So when I realized that that's the way I was doing economy, taking more than I needed, taking all I could get, I had to take a step back and say, hey, wait a second. And I would talk to my friends, and they looked at me like the deer in the headlights, like, what are you talking about? Like, it's just the way it is. It's the way it is, but has it always been that way? I don't think that the fastest tribesman or hunter in a native tribe got everything. They just went, wow, that dude can ride a horse. What's for supper? You know, like, it's the way society has been run now, being run now. So anyway, I started these conversations. And then, again, when you look at fear and you challenge these things, oftentimes it doesn't have any legs to stand on. And once you do that, a step reveals itself.
Well, as Private Joker suggested to a superior officer who wanted to know why he had Born to Kill on his helmet along with a peace sign, he said, I think I was trying to speak to the dichotomy of man. Mm. He said, what? He said, yeah, the Jungian thing, the dichotomy of man. Mm. And this officer told him to square himself away. But the thing is, I saw a pair of lithographs. They went together. And clearly this was from the Elizabethan period. I do not know the artist. I've forgotten. But the top one showed a table. Couldn't put another piece of food on it. Big turkey there. Everything was on the table. And all these well-fed people, let's put it that way. All right, fat people around there. They're in their billowing striped sleeves, and they're having a big time. And there's a skinny guy crawling in, trying to be unnoticed, and going for a crust of bread that's fallen on the floor. And there are two fat guys just kicking the H out of him. In the lithograph below, there are a bunch of skinny, emaciated people around a table, and they're trying to divvy up this partially skeletized fish remains. And there's a fat guy crawling in there trying to get a little crumb of something to eat, and there's a couple of skinny guys kicking him. And I thought, wow, is that really the way the world operates? I think there's a real dichotomy in our behavior. In fact, one of the friends of the program, Catherine, sent a message that said, I go to church on Monday and Saturday, and I feed the homeless, and I hand out clothes and things. And I wonder, am I doing this to help people, or am I doing this to atone for my own sins? How do I know whether I'm being selfish or selfless?
Yeah. Well, there's no such thing as a self in the truest sense that is not connected with another self. So I would ask that person, what is your intention when you do these things? Is this to inflate your own ego? That's why the scriptures say, forgive us to the atheists in the crowd. But that's why the scriptures say, don't let your right hand know what you're doing, and don't go out in front of the temple and tell everybody all the good deeds that you've done, but do these things secretly. That's when somebody has the intention of, like, look at how great I am, look at what I'm doing, you know, I'm a charitable person. But if you're doing it because it feels like there's a sense of purpose and meaning to your action, that you're touching another life, and that life, of course, is touching you. That's why we're here, to touch each other, to experience each other, to live in this soup, in this stew, and participate in this thing, this grand meal where there's some hungry and some overly fed. So I think that, you know, people say sometimes, aren't I really just selfish because when I do charity work, I feel, when I reach out, I feel good. So am I just doing it to be selfish? And I say no, because that self is connected to the great self, which is all of us. You reach out to another, and it's a mutual exchange. And so yourself is always connected with another. So just simply ask your intention. What is your intention when you go out and you serve? For your ego, or are you doing it because it feels like you're compelled to join in this human meal, if you will?
That's excellent. Well, I'll tell you what, I hear the music, which means that we have the heavy-duty, hard-core, can't-resist-it, immovable object known as the hard network break. But when we come back, let's discuss your documentary and some more of the the essence of these chapters in your excellent book, Life's Operating Manual, With the Fear and Truth Dialogues. Those are interesting too. But I want you to get this book. It's a nice book, and it's a nice little hardcover book, and it'll become one of your favorites rapidly. Tom Shadyac is our guest tonight, and this is Coast to Coast AM. We shall return.